Welcome back to the Rock Paper Bitcoin podcast. It's me, your very best friend on the internet, Business Cat. How are you? I've been doing pretty well. You know, the kids have snotty noses, but you know, I'm pretty good. This is episode 50, and that means it's special. We're joined by Mike from the High Hash Rate podcast. You know, one of our favorite podcasts, our brother podcast. It's great to have him with us, and it was a fun conversation. You're going to enjoy it. If you are enjoying the content that Mr. Fundamentals and I are putting out, you can support us. We don't have any ads. We're supported by plebs like you who listen with podcasting 2.0-enabled software. So, you know, something like Fountain FM, you can pick a sat amount you want to support per minute listen, and shoot it our direction. You can also leave us comments, zap us some sats that way. Man, I just can't talk this morning. Whatever, that's not important. We also have a Telegram channel. If you want to give us feedback, it's a great place to do it. There's always interesting stuff. I usually post stuff in there that I find... You know what? You just have to beat it. I'm not going to try to describe it. Yeah, I have nothing else. Let's get into the show, baby. In general, I feel like my brain synapses fire better in the morning, so that's why we have standardized mornings for our recording time. And then, yeah, so when we come on your show and we're up till like midnight, it's always like, all right, well, I'm probably going to seem like I'm kind of drunk because I've been up all day, but whatever, that's fun too.
Yeah, my IQ, clearly, it's down like 20% at that hour, for sure.
I'm always down 20%.
Yeah. It's fine, it's fun. It's like every show has their variables to make the show interesting. And yeah, that's just one of the variables for you guys' show.
Yeah. We're very glad to have you on this very special. This is a very special episode. And we're going to be covering some very important issues in society today on our very special episode.
Episode 50.
Yeah.
Was that Roman numerals, I think?
Yeah,
that's quite a milestone. It's quite a milestone, you know, to go that far.
Business Cat, it really feels like yesterday we were on the phone and we said, let's do 5 and see how it goes.
Yeah, but that might also be a like an artifact of the fact that time is moving incredibly fast and years and decades are happening in weeks now.
I mean, so it feels like yesterday, but it was like a lifetime ago.
The dilation, time is being dilated in a way that my mind can't really grasp time anymore. It's like, I've got kids, so that's dilating my perception. It's election season, that's dilating my perception. And then, it feels like we've been recording forever. And then it also is like, it feels like, we literally just started this last week at the same time. So my brain has no concept of time anymore.
But I think we're new. We are reinvented people many times over since we started.
Yeah.
You know, gosh. In fact, even like knowing, you know, having friends like Dan and Mike, they didn't exist in my world when we had that conversation, right? And, you know, it's like we just continue. I feel like we continue every time we discover new people that are become part of the community and friends that want to collaborate with us and just they enter our world, we become new people, right? So, like, we're totally new fucking people on episode 50 than we were when we started.
There's some people that when you meet them, you get the impression that you've known them or like, I've known you forever already. And like, I've known you for a lifetime. And I don't know if that's an artifact of like somebody you knew in a previous life, or if this is somebody like your brains just work on a similar wavelength, or you're both tier 2 consciousness, or I don't know where it comes from. But yeah, it's when you meet those people, it's they stand out from the NPC crowd behind them. And you guys at High Hash Rate was like, oh, I know you guys immediately. Like, I started listening to your show, and immediately I know you guys intimately and immediately and totally.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of that has to do with Bitcoin, you know, just because we're all sort of hopping on the same ideas, you know, that it has to offer. So we all end up meeting up and talking about it.
It's helped. I think it helps, right? It makes it probably puts us in a similar direction.
I mean, for sure, like having the commonality, the common ground of Bitcoin puts everything else into a better perspective because you know how people feel about Bitcoin. But like it's still early for Bitcoin, but there's so many people in Bitcoin now that I don't agree with anyway, that is like, that's less of a guaranteeing factor than it used to be. Mm-hmm. Other than like, I know that you're smart enough to to understand what currency is, and you're smart enough to want to protect you and your family. But other than that, like, I don't know. Yeah, that's
Most people
to be more of a guarantee.
Most people in Bitcoin, I don't see a kinship with most people, right? Mm. But then some people pop up, and you know, it just happens. So should we introduce our guest? Which is something we never say on the show.
This is true. Yeah,
we're so bad at this that we just
started talking. Yeah, you're right. We have a guest, folks. Yeah.
Like, I don't even know what. So this is Mike from High Hash Rate. I don't know. Like, what do you like to be called on the internet?
I don't think it matters. I think Mike from High Hash Rate sounds fine. It has a nice ring to it. You know, Mike from High Hash Rate.
I mean, everyone who listens to the show knows how much we love you guys and how close we are and how aligned we are. And it should shock nobody that, you know, of thinking of doing something special, having a guest on, we would pick one of these two guys. I'm guessing Dan never is up at this time. So,
you know, I picture him sleeping with like a mask covering his mustache,
but it's, I think we're going to talk a little. Why is it Mike? Why is it just Mike? I guess it just, you know, here. It's not because Dan told us to fuck off. Not this time. It's like we had a very specific.
On this one.
We had a very specific concept for this episode, and you know, it has to do with the fact that when we started season two, right? Many of you know this from the Telegram, but there is a certain individual named Mike that went really, really deep down the rabbit hole of what we were discussing, the geomagnetic excursion and the building of the Citadel. And, you know, like of all the people that we had in our conversation, Mike was like standing out as being particularly affected. Like, and, you know, maybe it was partly I don't know if it was an act or if it was legit, or either way, we were like, there was this like kind of meme going on. Like, have we checked in on Mike? Is Mike okay? Yeah, right. Like Mike was getting, we were imagining you in the fetal position, like listening to our episodes, you know? Right. So well, like you were definitely
you guys blew
like
my world for sure. You guys definitely made me think about a lot of stuff, you know, after that one episode, after what is it? 31 or I can't remember the number, but you probably remember the number.
What was the name of it, Business Guy?
Well, the name of it is Apocalyptic Equine.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's the one. Wow. So, yeah, that's a big one.
Right. So, you know, that because of your impact, like the way you were impacted by it, right? That set the stage for, that was one thing that we remember and we noticed. Right, that's not the full reason why we're here right now, but that's definitely like the genesis. Okay, I guess I'll introduce the whole thing right now. Does that make sense? We're so prepared and good at this.
Wait, the concept,
what are we doing here today? Like, so yeah, what we're doing?
What
so,
am I doing here?
So then we started season two. We all were affected by it. I mean, I don't know anyone who would be listening to this right now who didn't in some way, wasn't in some way impacted by this conversation, right? All of us were. Fast forward, I think, to so I was still working at my job when we started that, and you were as well. And then at some point, both of us found ourselves no longer working for our companies.
For the man.
And I immediately reached out to Mike when that happened. And I was like, dude, let's work on a fucking project together. We got to do something, right? This is like a sign from God, right? We're both like available to put our minds into something. And wasn't even thinking about anything related to what we talk about on our podcast. It's just like, you and me, brother, let's work on something. And what was the idea that we came up with that we locked in on? It was a game. And the title of the game, Mike?
Well, the title of the game is, it was up for grabs for a little bit, but I think we settled on Citadel.
Yes.
The name Citadel, just because it has so much content. You know, it's so integrated inside of the Bitcoin community. So it already has that, but it has this kind of, you know, stance of a, you know, intriguing idea, you know, behind it.
So that's the so that's the name of the game. You can, the object of the game is going to be to build a citadel. And Mike and I spent a good amount of time discussing, fleshing out what this game would look like, to the point where, you know, it was almost, we were probably like one or two really strong sprints away from like possibly talking to, you know, maybe starting to get somebody involved that could actually make it. And then, you know, and then Mike ended up abandoning the project because he found work. And
that's not true. I haven't abandoned it. That's true. I just
the point though, I want to make
burner, back burner.
Yes, but I want to get it. Like, I think we got far enough. I intended to get this out. I think our audience should hear about this game, and hear like sort of get involved in this conversation that you and I had, right? And then I think it's on the back burner.
Yeah, so you guys sent me the Google Docs for this game, and I looked over it, and so I am completely outside of this project you guys are working on. So, like, I looked over the document, and just from my outsider perspective, it seems kind of like a cross between Settlers of Catan and kind of a Dungeons and Dragons kind of RPG, where you're building a citadel and managing resources. It's like it looks very intriguing from a top level like glance over.
It has those elements, and I think we talked a lot about, weirdly, like, we talked a lot about Texas Hold'em.
Right, we did.
And how it's awesome, because it's a game that everyone in the game knows what the status is, right? So, like, you have your own personal strategy, and you have your own little secrets in the game, but everybody in the game knows what's going, what has access to, like, 90% of the information of what's going on. So we were relating it to those RPGs, but also to very basic games. So, Mike, do you want to kick this off?
Sure, I'll give it a try. I mean, so I think it actually all did stem from that episode, because after that episode, you start to think about your own position in life, your family, where you geographically are. And the resources that you have available to you. And you start to think about how can I, you know, shift these or, you know, shore up my side. So I'm not going to be one of these, you know, floating bodies at the bottom of a tidal wave in California. So I was thinking about this, and I can't remember if you and I were, you know, on some sort of conversation about games. But I do remember you were talking about games or something to this effect, maybe on the Telegram or something. And what I started to think about was, oh, well, you know, I grew up playing games, all kinds of games. I grew up playing Magic a bit. I grew up playing a lot of StarCraft, Warcraft, all of these, you know, God perspective, looking down, trying to, you know, manage resources and against, you know, other players on the field. And so what I started to think about was, oh, there's just such a fun element. And how big are these games, you know, like, especially something like Magic the Gathering, which you can, you know, they introduce new cards all the time to this game. You know, it just hasn't stopped since it started. And same thing with like Pokemon. So there's like these, but the thing about these card games and other games like it is that they all introduce a kind of attack vector, or they're all trying to basically attack each other. You know, it's a competition. You're trying to like get your opponent out and destroy your opponent. And in the future, that already seems like it's, you know, as we go along right now, you know, that already seems like it's the case. And it is the case, I guess, in humanity in general. But what I'm finding, and I think what most of us find, is that it's probably better to, and especially, you know, you guys talk about this on the show all the time, is like, it's better to work together and find common ground with people and be able to allow them to exchange with you, you know, and eventually you can have a more peaceful, prosperous, you know, society. So if you have all of these elements coming at you in this, you know, fiat clown world that we live in, it's gonna, yeah, it's gonna be difficult not to work together. So this is sort of the impetus of the game, is like, oh, maybe we could make a game where we all work together against a common goal, and
we can, right? And I think we had a tagline for the game that, like, many can win, all can lose.
many can all win, right. But all. So I don't. Here's the thing: is that it is still an ongoing project, so it's still being developed, and I think it still needs to be developed, but the premises or the premise not the premises the premise is
well it's a good pun
the premise is that you come to the game as a player along with any other players that you can play with, including you can play, you know, solo. This is the kind of game you can play solo, and the reason is because you're basically playing against the bank, you're playing against the house, much like you would in Texas Hold'em, which is why we started thinking about it like this.
We got very excited. We got very excited when we realized that there could be a solo, solitaire-like version of the game. We're like, oh my God, this is like, we got to get the difference between really, I think, getting through a very difficult barrier, which is getting groups of people to learn something and play together, versus like you get somebody who can play the game themselves against a protocol, right? That we got pretty excited about, right, about that fact. And it's not the same, but like you can learn the core, like we thought, like, well, you can learn the core, kind of the core strategies by playing with your, like, playing with yourself, by playing the game by yourself, right?
So when I think of playing against the house, I think of playing against the dealer or like the person playing as the banker. But so if you could play this by yourself, like, would you be, how's it work to play solitaire in this game?
So what we've come up with so far, all right?
Again, so the object of the game, first of all, right? Yeah.
It's good. The object of the game, yes. Again, and it's been, we're iterating on this, but the main object is to survive. That's basically it. It's to survive and hopefully to thrive. So we already have all of this shit coming at us in the world constantly. You know, it's like a, you can think about any other, you know, any kind of, you know, headline out today, and they just keep coming faster and faster about things that will affect our lives, you know, coming down the line, and will slowly just deplete us of energy constantly. You know, this is just like the rat race or the things that we all talk about in this space. And that would be sort of the fiat world, right?
Mike has three pages of bullet list of potential disaster cards. That, right.
So the way that you would play against yourself, or the way that you would play with anyone, is that there is a house, and it is issuing disasters. It is issuing monetary disasters, and it is issuing sort of physical disasters. So like. Or economic disasters and like physical disasters. So you can have something like you could have a card where it says your president has been assassinated. You know, this happens to your currency. This is how much you have to. This is how much you owe every turn now. Or, you know, there's lots of different like sidesteps. Unfortunately, we haven't dived in enough to like have any very, very specific rules yet. This is the sort of thing that we're starting to come around to, and that we're left idea, off on.
The idea was that you would operate in, you would have fiat currency and you would have hard money. And, you know, the fiat currency may actually help you survive better in a very, very short term, like in the next couple of turns. Mm. But the hard money, it would not be affected by these disasters, right? So if you could find people who could cooperate, to cooperate with, you collectively may actually find the balance of getting through enough turns to build a citadel, right? And avoid being, and then avoid, because that it's like the way you lose the game, by the way, is you go homeless and then one of these events just kills you. Right. It's like when you go homeless, you're like within a couple of turns of losing, of being eliminated. Right. So you want to have your home. You want to have a home. You want to have a structure that can withstand these events. Right. And that requires time. Like it takes time to build something that sturdy. Right. Like maybe everybody starts off in this is another so interesting thing. Like we had two worlds. We had an urban world and a rural world. And I think everyone started out in the urban world, right, where they're actually making a decent living in a fiat basis, but they have to find their way. These disaster things, they take out the urban worlds first.
So when you say world, is this like a game board? There's like an urban game board and a rural game board?
Yeah. I mean, okay. And imagine, yeah, certainly could be on a board, right? But imagine just there's two states of the world. There's two types of like living areas you could be in. One is an urban center and the other is rural, right? Okay. And I think we allowed maybe that you could choose. You could either be like a banker in the urban setting and you actually have a decent amount of fiat money but your expenses are very high and you're probably turn by turn you're actually losing money.
This is the beginning of Oregon Trail when you choose.
You got to get your ass out of there. Or maybe you start out in a rural setting, but you have nothing but a FedEx truck. that's your domicile, right? And so like, and the idea was that neither of these two should have an advantage where it's like, well, if I'm going to choose the one that has the advantage, right? The idea was that neither of those two would have an inherent advantage in the game, right? Both were equally as likely to get wiped out in the next five turns. Right?
And I should mention is that every turn you are issued one of these disasters. That was one of the things. So you start to have to prepare every single turn. You know, if a tidal wave comes, a tornado hits, you know, whatever your currency gets debased, these things will affect you region to region. And depending on where your character is, that's how that region will be affected.
Right. And it's more likely in the urban center to have sustained damage, right?
Right.
So I'm thinking about like what are my favorite physical things about games that I've played throughout my life. It's like I've never played Warhammer, but like that kind of figurine level, having a world that's awesome. But it's complicated. It's like it's the double-edged sword of all of these things. The trade-offs is like going fully to the level of you're going to create a little Warhammer collective in the Citadel collective that you're going to have move around the world. It's like, that's awesome. That sounds incredible. But then also, yeah, that's going to limit the amount of people that get into this.
What we wanted to do.
And then like the idea of cards, like graphics on cards and art is amazing. I love that.
We'd made some sample cards. What we really wanted to do is the simplest version of everything we just discussed. Like, what's the simplest version of that where, you know, it's like even if it's 10 turns and that's the game, just to show, right, like that we can actually implement these ideas, right, just to be able to implement very, very basic ideas in a game. Like this is like – and that's really what we're talking about. It's a very, very basic idea that shit is coming and you want to build the Citadel and how do you get people thinking about what is the strategy for doing that? Maybe the strategy is to go to New York, get a fucking criminal fiat job. You know, that's what a lot of people think, right? Stack as much MicroStrategy stock as you can. And, you know, I mean, so what we thought at the very end point, right? Let's say we had actually, let's say somebody had funded this and we developed a real game. Right. The idea would be that actually it could be run several times. It could be run billions of times and you could study the strategies that actually work the best. You know, not dissimilar to there was an episode we did where I talked about the Economics of Cooperation, that book by Robert Axelrod that had they had a game theory competition on the prisoner's dilemma. And they found out that tit for tat was the best strategy. And, you know, this would have been the kind of game where it could be run through many, many iterations and people can start to see, we can begin to discover what the strategy maybe should be. And then we would come back on the show and share it. Like, guess what? We ran a billion simulations of the game for whatever it's worth, right? Everybody, you know, it's kind of, everybody would have already been part of the open source discussion, which maybe we're starting right now, right? Discussion of what the parameters and what the rules and how the game really is. And then we get to understand, like, hey, guess what? You know, people that actually, people that just sell their New York apartment and move into a FedEx truck happen to have the best chances of winning.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's the case. I'm just saying, like, that, like, you know, that would be to be discovered. But that's, I think, what we were, you know, certainly for myself, like, hoping to build something that had the potential to discover these strategies.
The idea of teaching people that just because you live in a city doesn't mean you lack resources. Like, cities have their, like, on the timeline of what's happening, cities have their place. And like, in like, going and getting a high paying job, that's what I did with Deloitte. Whenever I had my orange pill moment of realizing, like, oh, I've figured out something the world doesn't know. It's like, oh crap, I need to go get a high paying job so I can stack as much sats as I can before the world figures it out. And like, so like, adding that to a game level.
You did
of,
that in Harrisburg. Though you didn't do that in New York City,
right? No, yeah, I was right. Also okay. Yeah,
to be clear, you did that in rural. You managed to do that in what we would be considering rural land. What did we even name for that, Mike? Did we even name?
Are these names? I can't. I have to bring up these names. Yes, I'll do it in the background. But
to look for resources and catalog resources ahead of time is. That and like the idea, I mean, I feel like people that are listening to this already are probably going to be on the wavelength of, yeah, cities probably aren't where you want to be for the long term in as the game is playing out. But like, that being said, there not all cities are created equal. And like, I think I live in town, but then what I think of in town is not what you guys think of in town. Like, I need to get even further out of town. It's like, I live in town. It's too much.
I found the names, Mike, and I can't. There's no context for.
Okay.
Shmusa and Gina.
Well, it's like USA and it's USA and China, but it's it's in like Trump terms or something like this.
Yeah, China. Like USA, Shmusa.
Gina.
We call it the Gina. I don't remember. We definitely got off the rails on our own laughing at certain shit along the way of this. We had a lot of fun talking about this and building this, I have to tell you. So maybe this is one of those.
This is the beauty of, I mean, this. You guys weren't necessarily granted this because of Bitcoin, but like, this kind of collaborative, like, creativity unlocking collaboration is what was one of the promises of what a hyper-Bitcoinized standardized world offers. Like, okay, what are you interested in? Like, what are your passions? Bitcoin incentivizes you to follow your passions, because your passions are going to be the highest, whatever your passions are going to dictate the highest quality thing that you can produce for the world. If you're passionate about it, you're going to do a better job than somebody who's not passionate about it. So figuring out your passions is one of the most important hacks. It's not even a hack. I mean, it's like a base level 101 level class that we should be teaching our children that we don't currently, because we need kids to fit into like what was manufacturing and office jobs. And like, we need you to not be creative because we need you to follow orders of a boss. But in a Bitcoin world, we need creativity. We need passion. And so you guys had this opportunity. You're both free of your fiat dependent requirements for this period of time. What are you going to do? Are you going to sit around and just do nothing, or are you going to collaborate? And like, you guys collaborated to build, like, start building this tower, and it's really awesome.
I was thinking of the leadership. Like, it started with, you know, Business Guy feeling so compelled to do this episode and to bring this conversation to the show, right? And then you have, like, I'm like the other side of it. That's like, all right, I'm listening, but I'm not as, you know, inherently as concerned, but I'm listening. I'm certainly listening to this conversation. And then all of a sudden it's now me and a friend of the show actually working on this, right? Now we're bringing it to the show and kind of telling you guys, well, I mean, I'm available. Mike's just not available really to put massive amount of time in this anymore.
That's really what comes in.
And so if anyone is interested in, anyone is listening to this and is like, I want this game to happen, you're going to have to reach out to me, because now, like, it's going to have to get picked up in an, you know, now in the open source community, right? That's why we're doing this right now.
I think it's a pretty important
thing to die in our heads.
Yeah, it's a pretty important concept to sort of wrap your head around. I think what's really fun about it is that you start to think about the strategy of your own life, you know, in this game. If your character is, you know, succeeding however they are in the city, but then you understand eventually as you play this game, you understand that they are susceptible to, you know, whatever problems the city might bring apart. You know, it could be, you know, a zombie apocalypse will likely destroy a city before it will a rural area. So then you think, okay, maybe I need to really consider where I am in my own life and my own position.
And yeah, like it's fine to frame things like a zombie apocalypse is a fun way to frame like disaster preparation for the uninitiated. Whereas, okay, what's a zombie invasion in real life? A fentanyl like invasion, like what we have downtown in like every city in America now is like it's effectively a zombie invasion. It's yeah. Not they're not coming for your brains. But
I would argue every financial district, what's happening in all of those high rises is a zombie apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
All these, like basically all of these employed zombies.
I think about this a lot, about what a zombie apocalypse is. I think about, and the thing that I really come down to is like, I try to boil it down to is like, what is a zombie? You know, a zombie is something that doesn't have resources, that needs to extract resources from a living thing. So a dead thing that needs to extract resources from a living thing. So if you have more and more people that can't afford or don't, you know, they can't give energy to their own life or bring energy to their own life, they need to extract it from the lives around them. And in something like a city where you have more denser populations, it makes sense that a zombie apocalypse, quote unquote, will happen if, you know, everyone is out for everyone trying to get something from them. Because eventually, all the resources are in these cities. So those people, everyone inside will pull from each other, sort of eating, eviscerating it from within. And then it, as it spread, you know, it'll sort of spread out in that way. And the rural areas will obviously be a little bit more, you know, insulated from this just by the sheer fact of their proximity to population. It just makes, and community sort of comes together in rural areas.
I think it's a lot harder to be a parasite in a rural area.
Mm-hmm.
It's not impossible, but it's just harder. It's a lot harder. You have to do
it's harder
yourself.
To steal your neighbor's Wi-Fi if they live 5 miles away.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, people notice you. It's kind of like if you are a kid and you go to a small private school, it's very hard for you to like cut school and do shit without people noticing, you know, without being noticed. It's just, it's hard to disappear in a rural setting. It's just hard. So it's hard to be an unnoticed parasite. I think the way we designed the game was that you were never, there's no scenario in the game, I don't think, where you stay in the city and survive. Right?
Eventually it's coming for you, sure, for sure.
Even though you may survive a couple turns because you're making, you have some more income coming in, but it's just you are absolutely destined for disaster. You're not going to make it. You know, it's sort of, probably a core idea of the game, right? You're not going to make it if you stay in Schmus, whatever we call it. Whatever we call the urban centers. Like if you, and you know, I know that's, I'm not saying that's true for people in our world, okay? I'm saying it's true for the average person in our world, right? And I think I want to see a game that helps people plan their way out of that, right? I think there's people living in cities that are based as fuck and they'll survive and they'll make it, right? They absolutely, a lot of these people exist. But the average person, I'm guessing, won't, you know? Now, we're talking underwater and all that, that's a different conversation. Just saying, in the general. I don't want to, I'm okay with getting a lot of hate for a lot of the things I say. I don't want people like yelling at me for saying that people in cities are fucking weak.
I mean, a lot of people live in cities, unfortunately.
I mean, a lot of them are weak, and it's just weak. But it's kind of like they're weak. They're not born weak. They're just weakened by their ability to depend on, be codependent on everybody else in the government.
You live in the city. You live out, like, I think of you as a Philadelphia person. You're in the city.
I possess the weaknesses of, I very much possess the weaknesses of somebody who's used to city living.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm and only noticing it, like, at this old age of mine now, right? Spending the majority of my life and setting the expectations of my life on what I have. And a lot of that was parasitic, not knowing it.
Also, what making this game made me think about is just because it's called Citadel. So the object is you're trying to, you know, build your own survival space. And as these cities sort of crumble in real time, you know, what we're seeing in real time, these citadels, and I think I spoke this on our show as well, but the resources sort of drain out of cities just because by the sheer fact that, you know, it eats itself alive. So everyone needs to sort of scatter out into a bigger radius. And, but they always, you know, people always want sort of a place of safety, you know, so they always be drawn towards places of fortification. And if you think about how all these people start to scatter out of these cities, new spaces will arrive. You know, this is not, I'm not even talking about the game here, but I, this, you know, 500 years ahead of us, you know, these places will build up, or they will become, you know, epicenters of resources coming to them, turning into new cities in a way. A citadel would be the new city, you know, a place that you can come to that has a set of rules, but you can leave that set of rules and go to another one. But it's just much more microcosms or much smaller of a structure.
Similarly to how at any time the U.S. goes somewhere and sets up a military base, a whole economy starts thriving right outside the walls of that base. And like that feels like this is kind of like this is going to be open sourced military base. I mean, a citadel is just, yeah, like a local group that's decided, all right, we're building our own thing. And like, if you follow our rules, you can play along with it. If not, stay outside of our walls. There's going to be businesses that set up outside the walls naturally.
Or we'll shoot you, or we'll, you know, we will defend ourselves in our citadel, you know, that I see that future, you know, for sure.
I mean, yeah, the absence of local law enforcement. I mean, okay. The future of, I mean, this is what Metal Gear Solid has been saying is the future of war forever. It's like the future of war is privatization. And yeah, I agree. I mean, it's like, we are each, Bitcoiners are kind of dividing up the world right now amongst ourselves. And I mean, we are claiming all of what's coming. And it's just the territory of what's coming is just like an order of magnitude, multi-orders of magnitude greater than what we have now. So it's like we're dividing up the universe. But like if you're not in the Bitcoin game, like you're not playing the game. Like you're not dividing up anything. You're staying in the city, you're waiting for the disaster to come, and you're not preparing for anything. But meanwhile, like if you're stacking sats, I mean you're making a claim in this world that comes. You might not have a physical you haven't like decided where you're going to put down your roots to a physical citadel location.
Starlink drop off.
But
it's always,
I mean, besides that, like you're still playing the game at least.
We're here.
Oh, and I'm, yeah.
You dropped off, buddy.
Well, I'm back.
Yeah, you're back.
Riverside got it. That's like,
good
it.
To see
so it. I guess, dear listeners, I'm on Starlink now. And what I discovered is that my Starlink dish is slightly obscured by the corner of our house. So every once in a while, I get a drop, packets drop. But other than that, it's the best connection I've ever had. But anyway, so sorry about that.
We'll have to get used to it.
How do you figure out that your Starlink is obscured slightly by, like, how are you figuring out the trajectory of your Starlink?
It's really, it sounds like I could give you a really technical awesome. Oh yes, I'm very technical and I figured it out. I used a protractor and all these things. No, like in the app, there's just a tab that it sets up like what's obscuring your device.
It gives you
a map of like what is invisible, the sky that is visible,
oh, nice.
That like with pixels, individual pixels, and then it will just as it's able to ping a satellite, that pixel will turn blue or red. And so in my, like the map that it builds me, I can see just a little clear corner of my house. And there's like, you can also see the little, like if you stand where the dish is looking, you can, and look up, you see the corner of my house and the chimney. And if you look on the map, you see just that. Like, all right, so I got
the last thing on the game, right? The last thing I want to point out that we think is really cool is that theoretically it never ends. If you play it right, you play it good, it theoretically never ends, and people who are find themselves good at it can figure out how to discover ways to keep it going. And maybe they figure out that in a one-person game, it's not possible. Even in a three-person game, it's not possible. But maybe they figure out that optimally, if they have like 7 or 8 people that they're collaborating with, it's possible to maintain your citadel in perpetuity. And like theoretically, you can keep just rolling turns. Mm-hmm. And as long as your citadel stays up, as long as you got, you know, as long as you stay alive, theoretically, there's no reason why the game necessarily ends. And it's not, the point wasn't to create a perpetual game, right? The point was to just create a world that brings in the sort of the economics and the game theory of people looking to survive the world we're in.
Have either of you guys ever heard of the video games Dwarf Fortress or Rimworld?
Dwarf rings a bell.
Rimworld. So these are rings a bell.
Okay, yeah. So these are both games that are kind of like what you're describing. They don't have an end. Dwarf Fortress is an old, it's a game that's been built in ASCII. So it's like, it's just the letters and numbers for the visual representation of the game. Yeah, it's a great style. It's difficult for people to get into, but it's an infinite game that essentially it gives you a map and you drop your dwarf somewhere. And then your job is just to manage this little dwarf empire. And like, you're not managing the dwarfs, or in Rimworld, I mean, it's a little colony. You pick a planet and then drop people on. Same general concept. But like, the idea is like, you're just managing a colony or an underground commune of dwarves. And like, they're going to do what they're going to do. Like, they're going to go out in the world. Some of the dwarves, like, you assign them, like, you're a builder, you're a construction person, you're a cook, like you assign them tasks, but then they go out in the world as your agents and accomplish things. And inevitably things happen that wipes out the colony or wipes out the mm-hmm. like the dwarf labyrinth underground. Like you'll have one dwarf who's really good at mining, and he'll just mine out so far that he mines into a river and it floods the entire thing and everybody drowns. It's like, but it's just one of those things. Like, there is no, like, the point of the game is to play the game. Like, it's not to, there is no winning state. It's just mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The point is to play a good game. And that's kind of like analogous to the point of life. Like, what's the point of being here? The point is to live a good life. Like, the journey in and of itself is the point.
It's, you know, and it's, I just got to say, dude, it's like, when you think about, especially in this context of, you know, we've talked about something called the infinite game before. That was a friend of mine. This is what launched the whole economics cooperation discussion. Cole Walmsley he wrote something I read about how he, this book called The Infinite Game. That's the context, you know, and that's the context that brings time preference into our conversation. But when you're really thinking about it, it ends up like obsessing about money feels really silly, right? Because if you make the one flip where you just, if the money is immortal and you flip what you call money now and for that, now you're really focused on the things you need to be focused on. Because it's like, you know, in math, you call it necessary but not sufficient. Like, it's necessary but not sufficient to operate with immortal money, with money that has an infinite time scale, that at least can have an infinite time scale, right? We could have a hour long conversation of whether Bitcoin actually has an infinite time scale or not. But let's take the case that it has the capability of
effectively infinite.
It is the capability of it. You know, once you're there, there's no game. There's no feature that says, oh, let's like figure out what the fucking money does. Right. No one's doing that. Right. You know, it's organizing economic activity, and then you do the economic activity, right? Mm-hmm. Which is build houses, build structures. It's just that there's no scenario where the current fiat money that started the, that you started the game off with is going to sustain you past a few turns. There's mm-hmm. just no, right? There's no scenario where you survive more than a few turns. I feel like it really highlights how almost ridiculous it is to obsess over money, right? And because it's just one little feature that we've sort of figured out about Bitcoin. It's one little feature, and that's why we never talk about money on the show. 50 episodes, almost never, right? Talk about what we are now worried about. Like, what's the downstream? Once we it's not fix the money. It's just we swap out the inferior money for this superior feature of almost infinite time scale, right? We swap that out, and now what are we worried about? What are we working on? Like, mm-hmm. almost everyone I interact with in the context of the podcast is either worried about a disaster, worried about their, you know, white knuckle hanging on to their sense of their salaries and their fiat jobs and like the stuff that we're really worried about in life, right? Which is like doing dishonest work or whatever it is, and like what to do about that, you know? And I love that this aspect of the game makes you sort of realize that, yeah, nobody sits around talking about what money is. It's like, that's got to be done. Like, you got to figure that. Like, you got to figure that out before you even play this game. Otherwise, you're cooked.
And I guess that ties into how Bitcoin is used in the game. You know, if this is something that we were still on the fence about, how we can manage this, but there's basically a limited amount of Bitcoin that enters the game. And you can, you know, use your fiat to buy miners. You can use your miners with the proper electricity to, you know, mine Bitcoin into your own stack. But on the fiat side, you know, fiat just keep, there are issues, you know, there are disaster cards that may issue, you know, double the amount of currency. So you start to grow the currency base or the fiat base around the board. So if you think about like a card goes down, everyone on the table reacts. And then another card goes down, everyone on the table reacts. So if a card goes down and says, you know, everyone gets double the amount of currency that they used to get, then you start to have this flood of fiat around, and you will naturally see the prices of things, resources. Maybe you have, you know, a wood resource, or you have an oil resource, or some, you know, whatever these cards you have. These things will naturally rise as you exchange with people, just because more people have more fiat, and we could all see it on the board, you know.
Yeah, we had this idea of a ledger. Oh, sorry, Mike, finish this.
No, I was just saying the Bitcoin, where Bitcoin fits in is that it would start to price itself in a market in the game. Like, it would start to rise regardless of what other set price, or, you know, I can't imagine someone like setting a price every turn. And instead, it's sort of market based. It's like, how much am I going to give you this Bitcoin card for? How much fiat are you going to give me? You know, this is what I'll sell it for. Or this is, I need resources right now. I will sell my Bitcoin for X amount of fiat because that's what you're willing to give me, or whatever yeah. the case. It's like this dance of like resources and money.
So we have this idea in the game that there's actually a running ledger that tracks all of the assets. We keep it simple, right? We have fiat money and either maybe a hard physical money and a hard digital money, but very finite categories, and that, you know, not by pencil and paper, but by computer. I insist that it's not complicated to track turn by turn. Now, I have not yet succeeded in writing that code to be able to do it or to even prototype it yet. I haven't figured it out yet, but like if somebody held a gun to my head and said, spend the next week doing it, I'm certain it could be done. So that we can have this world where we know what all the assets are worth, and, you know, that's a key part of the game. Now, I think that I think that if you play this game enough, right, I think what we tend to figure out is that Bitcoin is not something that you end up just necessarily trading for a whole bunch of fiat. This is a worldview thing of mine, but like, I think that what Bitcoin just is it's just a select, it selects who you cooperate with. And that's like the primary way it's used. And I think it's a primary way it's going to be used in our world. It's like, it's just going to select who you cooperate with. It may not even be worth anything, right? Other than selecting who you, but who you cooperate with literally determines whether you fucking survive the game or whether you get wiped out. So, and I think it may be one of those, even as a digital thing, it's a binary of binary use, like where it may only select who's in your community. And then once you have your community, there is no money. Everyone's just working to keep each other alive. I don't know whether to get into this or not, but like I listened to a podcast a week ago that blew my fucking head off. It blew my fucking head off. And it's this guy, Owen Benjamin. Do you guys know who that is?
Yeah, I do.
So I got a shout out to
I guess, who is Owen Benjamin?
Linkin Park Rules tipped me off to this podcast by Owen Benjamin. He was a stand-up comedian who has done like 8,000 podcast episodes. He's one of those who's, I guess, has been doing it. Nobody really knows who he is, but he's been doing it as long as Rogan and Carolla and those guys. And this was about, this particular episode was about how the movie John Wick, which I still have not seen. So I haven't even seen the movie John Wick, but like he was basically making this case that John Wick is about the Federal Reserve. And that it's all about, like, they have their own rules about actually business guys.
I'm sure fucking, yeah, I'm trying to imagine
recoiling how into a fucking paint. He's recoiling.
So
into
who killed the dog? Like, is the Federal Reserve?
I haven't seen the movie, so let me just make a quick point and okay. Why I'm talking about it. Okay, and maybe we'll have a watch party for John Wick one of these days. But
great movie.
But it's all basically saying within the like that there is this hotel. Now, mind you, I haven't seen the movie, so I'm going to describe this as someone who hasn't seen the movie. But apparently, there's this hotel where, like, none of the rule, like,
oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
There's this hotel where there's none of the rules apply, where everyone is like safe and nobody could kill each other, and mm-hmm. within the rules of this hotel. So, in other words, within the walls of this hotel, there's this code of honor that everybody is under, and you know what Owen Benjamin was saying was that this is like, even though these are evil people. Right. And nobody, everybody complains that they're evil people and shouldn't exist. They actually like try living in their shoes. If you tried living in their shoes, you might realize that they are operating under a code of honor that actually would surprise you and that you may not understand. And that in their world, it's not about money. Nothing's about money. In their world, it's all about access. And so you either have. And so that's why, like, apparently, like, if you take a marker out, a debt, it's a favor that you have to do. You can't question it, right? That's part of the code of honor, and I guess that's the premise of the movie, is that John Wick violates his code of honor and he's marked for death because he didn't want to uphold whatever. So I'd made this extrapolation personally that's like what we're doing with Bitcoin. You know, when I say the illusion is that things get more expensive, and that's what they want you to think inflation is, but the reality is things become unavailable. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, it's not that your refrigerator is getting more expensive. It's like you can't fucking buy a refrigerator anymore that is going to last more. It's like it doesn't exist. It's poof, gone, right? It's about access. Like, it's about access to the people that actually can build shit for you. It's about access to the people who are going to help you survive. And I like framing it this way because I feel like it's just unique and a useful way to look at it. Like, what if you never trade it for a lot more fiat? What if literally you only trade it for access to people that you're going to build your life with and survive with? And I felt like building the Citadel game coincided with this idea. And then the John Wick thing, like, really popped it out for me. And I've been talking about it a lot. I've been with a lot of people this week. And that's like, you know, Mike and I will argue about stuff like that, right? It's like, oh, I don't know if you're going to trade Bitcoin for 50,000 fiats. I don't know if that's how it's going to be, right? We really spend a lot of time arguing these things out. I will treasure that time, Mike. I will actually really will always treasure the time we spent building this game. and hope it. I hope maybe somebody out there wants to jump in.
I definitely don't think it's. I haven't put it out of my mind like it's over. I want to continue. It's just my own, you know, fiat life is clawing me into it. You know, it's clawing me back from spending time on things.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. This is part of the game.
Yeah.
Right?
It's true.
I mean, I'm by the way, we are all very happy, and we're very happy for you. We wish nothing but the best for you, and we're very happy that you have, you know, you've landed.
And dude, yeah, congratulations. That, like, I hope it all works out. That's really awesome. Like, I don't know how much we want to, like, say it in open to the audience, but yeah, like, it's awesome that, like, somebody, yeah, you went from, like, you caught a big fish.
Yeah, and this will release on Thursday, so, like, it won't be like, you know, if we didn't release these things for like 3 months, and then when it got released, it was somehow you had lost that job. That'd be awkward, right? But no, we're very happy for you, man.
Well,
we're very happy not to be working on this game, and for the reasons why we're not working on this game anymore.
Ah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that it's a it's an ongoing process. Trying to maintain a life and kids and, you know, all these things. It's obviously very,
yeah, I hear you,
lots
man.
Of juggles, you know. I could hear yours in the background, you know.
Yeah, there's some chaos going on in my house right now. Jumping back though to what fundamentals you were saying, you're talking about access, like Bitcoin gives us access. It's in, like, me thinking about, like, what do the communists want? The communists want us to, like, everybody needs to have equal access to everything. And, like, in execution, that means that nobody has access to anything. Like, you go to the grocery store and it's just, there's bare shelves. And it's, right. Oh, good, we're all equal. There's no food for anyone. And then it's, like, bread for everyone. What does that mean in like, execution in communism? It's like, oh, there's going to be lines for bread around the block. Because maybe if I line up early enough, I get up early enough and get in the line, maybe I'll get some bread. It's like, that's, and yeah, like, have Bitcoin offers the opportunity to exist in a marketplace that is just, okay, I mean, there, it's a marketplace of abundance because you're operating from passion. You're operating from people that actually want to participate versus like, oh, well, the boss says I have to get up and go to my government job where I make government bread and hand out government cheese. It's like, it's a difference of first principles.
Yeah, I mean, look, even just stupid example, but my coffee that I drink, which is a big part of my day and what powers what I do. I'm a full-time learner right now, right? And, like, you know, my coffee is very special to me, and that coffee comes from a friend who, you know, who I met through the Meshtadel. And, you know, it's not that he only takes Bitcoin and that's why I have access to his coffee. It's that we met because we share the same worldview. And, you know, he knows I want to, like, I actually honor his work by paying for it in Bitcoin. It's actually just really clunky and shitty. Like, do you ever go out with a buddy and it's like, you don't, can't figure out who's going to pay. And it's like, shitty. It's like a shitty 20 minutes of your time together by, like, trying to figure out and argue about who's going to pay and all that stuff. And it's like, yeah, we don't want that in our space. And Bitcoin allows us to just, he just knows now. He just sends me the coffee, sends me an invoice, and there's nothing else to it. And, you know, that's, so I have access to, like, a really good coffee roaster who I think is a really good person also. And we align. And I could say that about several things, right? I could say that about the food we eat, right? Business Cat and I can both say that about the food we eat. And having Bitcoin as the medium of really the medium through which we connect with that consumption is a big part of it.
Karma-free, right? Food.
But it's more that we have access. It's just more like, it's like the last 2 years I've spent talking to agrarian contrarian about food, right? Under, like, after already having made the connection, like, there's no way, like, we would talk to each other if it wasn't, like, if we weren't connected by an ideal, we wouldn't have these honest conversations with each other about what's important to us. So it's just like, I don't know how to, you know, I'm saying, I think what I really would like to say is that it's more, it's just such a bigger world than exchange. Like, I'm just going to exchange my Bitcoin for $1 million so that I can survive. I mean, it's probably going to have to do that one of these days. But it, what we're really built, you know, it's more that I'm going to have it. I'm actually going to, I have a pretty good chance that I'm going to be able to eat meat because I have farmers that know that I'm for them because I'm already exchanging Bitcoin with them. You know, and I don't even think this is that abstract of a conversation, right? It's like, that's why I'm very pro spending your Bitcoin. I'm very pro, you have to build, Citadel can mean a lot of things, right? But, you know, in our real Citadels, in our real lives, it's your access to food, your access to healthcare, your access to friends, and your access, right? It's just like your access to, and people doing the same for you, right? Like, what are you doing for them such that besides just being a Bitcoin bag for them, what are you doing for them such that they want to keep you alive, right? I think that's us. That's our conversation. And I think it's so cool that we built a game that tried to kind of track, kind of tried to bring that into real life.
Yeah, it's what kind of value are you putting out into the world as opposed to what kind of value are you extracting from the world? And I think the world will return, you know, value back to you if you're putting value into it, for sure.
Authenticity is important, I think. And like people can tell when people are not authentic. I feel like I can. Flashing it, like, I feel like Tucker Carlson's been mentioning this a lot recently on his shows when he was doing the tour across America, that truth rings differently when it hits your ears. And even on things that you can't verify, like, I agree with that. Truth hits differently when it hits your ears. And I think that's why, Mike, you freaked out so much when we talked about like apocalyptic equine. It's like you hadn't done the research to like verify all of that, obviously, because you hadn't heard of it. But then like being presented by it, it filled in gaps that like you realize like, oh, I didn't realize I had been asking these questions. This answers a bunch of questions. Oh, this is true. Oh no, if this is true, what does that mean about like all of these other decisions I've made about my life? And it's like, so like when like hitting like going through life, like having that, what does that boil down to? That means like trusting your gut feeling. And there's like a lot of people just don't trust their gut feelings because like, oh, well, my brain, this doesn't make any sense. If this was true, somebody would have told me about it. Like the government would tell me if this was true. They would tell me that like, I mean, it's like, whatever, pick your reason why people don't believe things. But like truth hits differently and authenticity also hits differently. And like in a world, like in the Bitcoin world that we're building, where it's built on passion, what are you passionate about? Okay, pursue that. Somebody who's passionate like about anything is going to produce a better product. So like it, in the beginning, like, hey, as you're learning your passion, it's going to be rough. Like it's rough for everybody. Like it's, you struggle like in, like maybe there's, it turns out 1 million people are passionate about baking bread just because it's a pretty easy thing to do. You're quickly going to determine in your neighborhood who is really good at baking bread and who's not. It's like, that's like, these are the kind of like market feedback things that we're finally going to have back in our lap because of like the Bitcoin world that we're going into. So like, authenticity is key. And like, it's important to nurture that and not be a fake person and like put it like, what does the world want me to be? Or how can I please people? Like the internet offers us an infinite audience currently, effectively infinite audience. So while the internet is around, and I think there's a solid case to be made that the internet will survive the pole shift. But like while it's around and there's an infinite audience available, like there's grass to be mowed, there's bread to be baked, like there's plenty of opportunities to stack sats for people.
Yeah, absolutely, dude. What you just got me thinking too was like, it's inauthentic to obsess about money, right? And it's like, it's another reason why we have to just get over that. And that, you know, let, and it's again the selection process. You kind of get Bitcoin. It doesn't take I don't think it should take 5 years of, and I, you know, contrary to some of my best friends, right? I don't know if you really need to listen to 40 hours of Bitcoin podcast a week to
Well, that was the case before, but if we're doing our jobs now, it should be easier.
I think you have to be better. And I think part of that joke is just that, you know, you kind of have to be better than that to get like what you may not have access, what everybody may not have access to is their own, is the strength of that conviction to not need, you know, to not take 5 years and to not have to suffer through scams and just to see something very clear, to see this thing very clearly and get it, I think is, I'd like to think that as time goes by, it takes less and less for people to understand it. I think that's, you know, I think like when I got in later than all you guys and I was less, there was more education. There were more podcasts, but there were more authentic podcasts. All I'm saying is that I think it's inauthentic in general to obsess about money. Right. So the quicker you just understand this thing for what it is, the sooner you're not obsessing about money and you're actually thinking about building and what you need to do. Right. And because you want to connect with people who are over it, who are over what money is. You want to connect with those people. Right. You want to access those people. And then you want to start figuring out how to add value to those people. And that's how, you know, like that's how we make it. But go ahead and listen to 40 Hours of Bitcoin Podcast too. I guess that's okay. Shall we move into shall we wrap the Citadel and move into our the fun segment?
I think it's going to be yeah for sure. So we have the film guy here. So let's talk about films.
We have a film man.
I mean, the intention was to just like focus on Star Wars, but like, I mean, we can talk about Star Wars, but let's just talk about let's just leave it more open than that, and let's just talk about movies.
Like I already brought up John Wick, a movie I haven't seen, and made a giant extrapolation off of a podcast I heard on a movie I haven't seen, and I made it very confidently.
So I'm curious if you had to rank, let's say your let's not even top three, but just three really good movies that you think kind of define you. What do you think those three are?
Can I quickly just point out that the world of the Citadel is really based on this world of Star Wars? And in that Star Wars has, you know, a multitude of planets and societies and civilizations that feel like they have built after an apocalypse or after a global event like what we're describing in this game. So the pockets of places and governments and things have sort of distributed out. And I just wanted to decentralize, you know, out into the sky, out into space. So Star Wars, I thought, was a great sort of
additional topic. Yeah.
Having your planet vaporized, man, that's a natural disaster.
But there are...
has been vaporized.
But there were ones that lived under... Like, there were the Mon Calamari that lived underwater, right? You had... Maybe they got like pole shifted and they had to figure out how to, like the survivors figured out how to grow gills and live underwater.
Well, having access to hyperdrive makes a pole shift less of a catastrophe when you can just like get off the planet. Like, all right, we're just going to jump up into a spaceship for a while. It's like, we're kind of stuck here on the planet. It's like, so until we figure out the, just hop up out of the gravity well bit of Star Wars, the disasters have a bit more finality to us. But yeah, so Star Wars has, I don't know, do you want to go, like, so let's go with your movies, so we don't have to talk about my Star Wars past.
The question, well, I was kind of interested in your Star Wars discussion, but the movies that had the most impact on me, is that the,
I can't remember, maybe defined you the most, maybe what defines
it's you. Number one is Fight Club. It's the go-to, you know. It's the internal voice, you know. It has,
yeah.
There's so much inside of that film that spoke to me, but that's simply because of a lot of personal stuff that I was going through at that
time.
When
did you first see it? Did you see it in theaters?
I did not. I was too young. I was 13 when I saw that film.
Well, that's a good age for it.
Oh, it's a very pivotal age. It's like the age in which you are switching into from childhood to manhood, right? And this is the film that I saw, was this sort of, it's like, I mean, there's too many, so many like offshoots you can go with this discussion, but essentially it's really about becoming a man, understanding that just self-destruction is like not the way to do it. Like it's, you just destroying everything around yourself and bringing everything down to zero is a sort of communist, you know, level style of thinking. But I didn't understand that at the time. So I, you know, it pushed me into this direction. This film pushed me into this direction of rebellion and, you know, going against the man. And as I grew up, as the character grows up throughout the film, you start to, or you realize like, oh, being the man, there is an aspect of being the man that is important, or the man is important to a degree. Like there is a having authority or understanding what authority gives us is a very important, like it's an important aspect of society. Like we can't really function without some kind of governance. And this is, you know, that, I mean, what other kinds of aspects I can go off on a tangent for sure. But no, it's a very impactful movie for me, you know, filmmaking.
Fundamentals, have you seen Fight Club?
And I have not seen Fight Club. Can you believe that?
I'm going to ask you these quite like that immediately.
You believe that? I haven't seen okay. Like every fucking, I haven't seen John Wick, the two, or Fight Club.
Well, also, I mean, like, you were a super leftist for most of your life. That makes sense that you haven't seen the best films in the world.
For that, I guess, during the years 2000 through 2020, I probably missed out. There's a list of movies I know are like the best ever that I know I haven't seen. And for, I don't know why I continue. Like Braveheart is on that list.
It's a great film. Great film.
It's a great film.
At some point, it's just like I have friends that are like, I can't believe you haven't fucking seen that movie. And I'm like, oh, fuck you. You
know? Everybody has films like that, though, that it's like everybody else has seen that they haven't. It's like, Yes. I've never seen The Goonies, and I'm the right age for it, and like the right demographic for it, but I've never seen it. So yeah, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah,
Fight Club is great.
It is the goat. It's the goat of that genre, I guess. Whatever that.
I'm about
genre
to see
is.
It now that I know it's had such an impact on you. So because there's, I'm probably
I think
can't
like
only
Fight
know
Club
you
is
so
a movie
much.
That little kid that like a 13-year-old should see. Like there's movies that I'm queuing up. Like what? How am I going to? Like, what kind of film education am I going to give my offspring? And, like, Fight Club. Like, my little son, he's going to watch Fight Club when he's like, 11 or 12 or 13. That age for it. Like, that's, like, the lessons that movie teaches little boys is important. And it's, like, that movie talks about the fact, like, we have no great war, no great struggle. Like what is our great war? Like, what is our struggle is internal. Like, the great war is a war with ourselves. It speaks to our generation, like the hopelessness that men, like, what is the quote from Thoreau? Men live lives of quiet desperation. It's like, I don't think a lot of women or to understand the reality of that statement, just how desperate men are. Like, I mean, I just speak for myself. Like, I know how desperate I was, and I mean, still am to a degree, but like the desperation that was in my life before I found Bitcoin and like found something to do with my life and like to like realize like I had to grow up and assume some responsibility. Like I was desperate in a way that is dangerous to the world. And like, that's a lot of guys. Like that's not a good place for society to be. So the movie Fight Club speaks to guys very differently than it speaks to women. Like my wife tried to watch Fight Club with one of her girlfriends, and like I don't, they turned it off and didn't get it. And like
how do you
I remember
off
laughing.
Fight Club, man.
I know it's like it's not for them. It's fine. It's not for them. Like it's not. It's for boys, and like it's important. But okay, yeah. Fight Club.
I don't get it. Why do they just why?
No. Yeah.
All right. So that is one of the most impactful movies for you. Let's go to Brian, Fundamentals. How about you? What do you think is one of the most impactful movies you've ever seen?
So the most impactful movie I have ever seen was Star Wars. And it kind of really began. I mean, I was, so I was 4 years old when Star Wars came out, and I did not go. My family begged me. They wanted me to go, and I was too afraid.
Do you remember that?
Yes. I distinctly remember imposing my will on my family and not going. And they went anyway. And then I remember going into like kindergarten and hearing everyone, what they did this summer was go see Star Wars. And I felt like a fucking douche. And then I remember going to go see Empire Strikes Back. I'm pretty sure I hadn't seen Star Wars because this was 1980. But I'm like, I'm not making that mistake again. And I hold Empire Strikes Back as like the greatest movie I've ever seen in my life. And then shortly after that, my family came across a VHS tape that had both the movies on it. And I literally watched them every day for well over a year. I would come home from I was a latchkey kid, came home from school and just popped that in to the point where I could literally say the whole script from front to back of both movies. And I would often put friends through it where, you know, so like, and then, you know, as a kid, man, I just imagined having the power to do the right thing. Right. It's you know, to me, that's like what Star Wars is all about, is just having like not being helpless. Right. Like, you know, being up against just awful power and not being helpless for it to, and you know, the Luke Skywalker character just, you know, it means, I think it means a lot more to people like who grew up watching, who saw the film in movie theaters with and spent most of their life without the internet, just dealing with rumors of what might happen. But like to be affected at that age, like pre 10 years old of that type of, that type of hero's journey, you know, Return of the Jedi, which I was 10. It was either 9 or 10 when that came out. And then you knew it was over. And you had nothing to think about but that for decades, right? And then we had books. But all the books did was continue the legend of Luke Skywalker, really. You know, that he had his, you know, his bout with the dark side, you know, he did, you know, there were books about that. There were books about him, you know, starting a whole new Jedi Order and all that. But I mean, that's really what it was all about. And I just remember being in my, you know, like elementary school, just like trying to will the Force, trying to will power.
Trying to move your pencil across the table. Oh yeah. I've been there.
It wasn't just for the trick of it. It was like, I really felt like I needed to know that I could affect something in the world. You know, I feel like that I knew I was up. At that age, I knew I was up against like something horrible and felt like I needed some way to know that I could actually wield some type of power to cope with it.
Star Wars is powerful. It affected me. I mean, my first name is Luke. So growing up with the name Luke, I mean, yeah, it was first and foremost. And everybody in the world said, "Luke, I'm your father," to me, except my dad, until like I was an adult. He finally did it once. And I was like, oh, that was weird. So I'm not old enough. You're a bit older than me. Like I wasn't old enough to see it in theaters. I saw Star Wars on, my parents would rent a VHS from the local tape store, bring the VCR home, or rent a VCR. And then, yeah, that's how I saw it. Rented VCR and rented tapes.
Yeah, I mean, and even to go even deeper than just seeing it in the theaters, like the experience of living in the world. In 1980, when Empire Strikes Back came out, my parents owned a Burger King in West Virginia. And we used to go there for the summer. And it was like, that detail's ridiculous and stupid, but you had Empire Strikes Back, like glasses and gear from places like Burger King, like everywhere. If you ever watch a TV show that was set in like 1980, you'll just see somebody pull an Empire Strikes Back glass out of their cupboard. And I remember this shit like it was yesterday. And we had so much of it because of because we owned a Burger King franchise and we just had all these little fucking knickknacks that came in the Happy Meals and shit was everywhere. I mean, in if you the action figures, everything, you got to get like 1980. There really wasn't, you know, again, whatever the few things they told us were important, we were inundated with it. And everybody knew about it. Everybody was participating in it. Right.
So you saw Empire and Jedi in the theaters, but not A New Hope. What was it?
Yeah,
so,
right.
But then, so then later in the late 90s, they did the special edition releases. It's like, which I imagine you went back to see in theaters. It's like,
I did, but it was like,
it wasn't the same thing.
It didn't matter that much. I was in a, you know, it didn't matter as much. I mean, I'd already watched Star Wars like easily hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of times. Right. So all it really meant was I think it was like some special effects, which I thought were shitty. I didn't like the changes they made.
Interesting. You know, so you're already jaded at this point. You were already Star Wars jaded
at this
point.
I didn't like Han Solo's conversation with Jabba the Hutt.
What do you think of the prequels then? Because they did the special editions and then they rolled out the prequels. Where were you on the prequels?
The prequels, I was part of the horrified people that thought their lives were ruined by certainly the Phantom Menace. All we had was hype. I mean, we had books and hype for, what was it, 1983 to 1999, right? So for 16 years, there was nothing but rumor. Hey, did you ever even hear about this thing called the Clone Wars? Well, that was mentioned. Like, you know, it was mentioned in A New Hope. But, like, there was this whole thing, apparently, and they're going to make a whole movie about it. This was like, there were these rumors that would circulate in, you know, urban legends and things like that. But then when we found out it was going to happen, and then, you know, the internet was really like, you know, I talk a lot about the fish and how the internet came right in time to like make them as big as they were. But like also the rumors of the new Star Wars happened. We're talking mid-90s, right? Right when the internet was coming around, and it was just like, it was gas. Like it was absolute gas. And all you had for 3-4 years was now like real hype and speculation. And, the best way I could describe it is the movie Fanboys. If you guys have ever seen that one?
I have.
You know? And like, oh, Mike, you got to go. It's so good, dude. It's
you haven't seen Fanboys?
Yeah, fuck Fight Club, dude. Fanboys is
fairly obscure.
It's incredible. And it's about a group of friends, and one of them is dying. They're big Star Wars fans, and one of them is spoiler alerts, but one of them is dying of cancer, and they decide they're going to go to Lucas's ranch.
It's not a spoiler. He doesn't die in the movie.
They're gonna drive to that's the spoiler. No, so the idea is they drive to Luke's ranch so they can watch the movie before he dies, right? And that's the adventure. And you know, it's like, it's just so fucking good, dude. I highly recommend it. But anyway, they finally get there. They go through all the trials and tribulations and watch it. And of course, the big payoff of the movie is their reaction of how fucking like it almost. I think it almost fades to black right after they show them the end. Right?
What if the movie sucks?
Yeah, and then there's this moment where I think they're talking to each other like, well, yeah, what if this movie actually sucks? You know, like they don't really know whether to hate it or not.
Have you heard of the Red Letter Media Plinkett reviews of the prequels?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. I've watched them many times. I've watched them with my kids because they're so fucking funny.
Oh my god, they're some of the most so educational good. From like a filmmaker's perspective. Yeah, they're arguably the Plinkett reviews of the prequels are better than the prequels themselves.
As are like the Robot Chicken, you know, like, do you ever see the Robot Chicken episodes? The Family Guy spoofs, the Robot Chicken spoofs, a lot of them are better. And frankly, they're funny. They're really good. The Family
Disney
Guy ones
is screwed
are really good.
Now because of how good all that stuff was. It was like the Robot Chicken was incredible. Robot Chicken riffing on Star Wars is some of like the peak Robot Chicken, peak Comedy Central content that's ever been produced. And now,
Absolutely. Now
Disney owns it. Now Disney's like, no, we're going to clot all of you other creators who were living in our universe, like writing books and like making these, like making clip art stuff with Robot Chicken. Is like, no, that's all unlicensed now. Nobody can do that anymore. It's all in Disney House now. So now they try to do it and it's terrible. Like, have you seen the little, like, what is it? Star Wars shorts or something?
I don't bother with any, honestly. I mean, I watch so
it's
much.
It's embarrassing.
Like, I watch more than most. I watch the fucking rebels and, you know.
Well, we have an LGBT stormtrooper now.
And all that. But, like, just real quick on the robot chicken, right? Do you guys, like, so they did a sketch about, remember when they go into the Mos Eisley cantina and then there's this pig nose guy that's like, we're wanted men, you know. We, you know, he doesn't like you, right? And in the robot chicken sketch, that guy who he has that big, he looks like an alien with a, like, a fucking tongue sticking out of his mouth. You hear, you see the subtitles where he's like, no, I didn't say that at all. What are you talking about? And he's like, no, I don't like you either. And the other guy's like, no, I like you just fine. You know?
Yeah, they're just like office like, workers out, idea. Out for drinking. Yeah.
It's a brilliant idea for a sketch where, well, that, what if that guy like just was not, like, yeah, they were just going across the street for some lunch on their lunch break, you know? And this guy just decides to go fucking, and then all of a sudden, yeah, Obi-Wan just fucking slices the guy's arm off. And, you know?
Mike, I'm guessing you've seen Star Wars.
You know, the first Star Wars I saw was Phantom Menace.
That was your introduction? Right. Like, that makes sense. There's got to be those people.
I think this came around the same time that Fight Club did. I don't know. I can't remember. It was like 99, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I remember, you know, hearing the hubbub of being such a big thing. But and obviously seeing it, you know, it's. But no, I hadn't seen it until Phantom Menace, and then the introduction to that world is sort of interesting to me. But it's not until I got into film school, it's like, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7 years later, that I actually sat down and watched the original trilogy, and was like just blown away about, you know, this is way ahead of its time, obviously. This sort of like just created the entire genre next to 2001 Space Odyssey. Those two films in tandem. And I think Solaris is another one. That entire genre and the visual language of that genre, it opened up a lot. For me, I got a little bit more into sci-fi because of it. But it certainly didn't have the kind of the impact or effect that you're describing. I don't think I grew up I played a lot of video games, RPGs, things like this, but I was heavily into like heavy metal and trying to like work that scene, skateboarding and rollerblade, like trying to be a hardcore kid, I guess. So I wasn't.
What bands were you into?
Slayer, dude. Slayer, oh, okay. Metallica. Those were like the duo.
Yeah. All right.
You know, you're trying to learn Master of Puppets.
Yeah. I mean, by 99, Metallica was they were considered posers by that point.
Yeah, right? Exactly. They came with Reload, they came up with.
You guys know that was my first concert I ever went to, was Metallica.
A Metallica concert.
Yeah. And like 1992. I was terrified, scared out of my fucking mind. Actually, they'd never been to a con. I thought it was just going to be a bunch of people there in spiky clothes trying to stab me. You know, it wasn't. It was fucking great. You know, so good. 92 was like that borderline right before they got really, you know, right before the Black Album. I don't know if it came out. I don't know if the Black Album came out in 92 or 91, but it was sort of like, even when it came out, it wasn't like people hadn't picked up on it yet. And Metallica was still mostly the band they were prior, right? Crazy, dude. They really were legit. They had a real energy. So that's interesting. And Slayer was the real deal, though, back then. Then you know they were. So you were trying. You were trying to. It's so funny, dude. This not to dox you too much, but like me, like a little suburban Jewish kid, trying to get some respect in the world, right?
Probably. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
At that time, Star Wars did not offer that. Star Wars did not offer that in the 90s in any way.
That's right. It was sort of the neutered version. It wasn't owned by Disney back in the Phantom Menace days, right?
No. Disney didn't happen.
Just on the trajectory to do.
We're talking, I want to say early to 2010s. Early 2010s was when Disney came in. Right, maybe 2013, 2014, something like that.
God, they really bubbled it all out, right? It really, they just sort of washed it all into this, like, I don't care, plasticky sort of whatever, bubbliness.
I heard somebody put it that the Star Wars universe is a mile wide and an inch deep. And it's like, so like they put all this money into it thinking, oh, we can do all these things. We can have like, we can have part of like Disney World can be Star Wars and we can make all these movies and TV shows and stuff. But then they got into it and it's people just want to see what they've seen before. So like they, the Force Awakens, and the Force Awakens is just A New Hope over again. And it's like the going through these steps of like, and then what was the next film was Rogue One, which was like the best fan flick ever made by Star Wars. Like, all right, what do fans like? X-Wings and like AT-AT walkers and like all these things. And then they tried to make it gritty, but then it was also trying to like be funny, and they had like funny droid. It was a weird, it's very clear that there's no, like, it went from being George Lucas, somebody with maybe not vision. He had vision at one point, but like one person making decisions to a committee making decisions. And yeah, like the sheen, the glassy, yeah. The
you can see the
sheen of it is
like,
might've
been the best one they did though. Rogue One might've been the best of that batch.
I don't know. I think the thing that like Star Wars was dead to me at this point. Like it's a corpse. It's rotting on the beach. I don't care about it anymore. So like I went and saw Force Awakens. Like, okay, great. Don't care. I saw Rogue One. It was like same thing. I was like, this is a really great fan film. But like, yeah, okay. I went to see Force Awakens to see like, is Star Wars like, can it breathe some life back? And they're like, nope, don't care about it. And then I went to Rogue One to confirm that. And the thing that made Star Wars like briefly bring like life back to the corpse for me, like, oh, I briefly felt like what I used to feel for Star Wars was the first season of The Mandalorian with
which was excellent.
Baby Yoda. It was like, that was incredible. Like Baby Yoda and dad running around for a season was great. But then, yeah, season two was gone over, like lost it.
I disagree.
I mean, right. It's like, this is,
I liked the second season. You liked Rogue One. Fucking total garbage. But I like the second season of The Mandalorian. But mainly because, I mean, you understand, like everything I described about what it all meant to me as like a child, like to finally bring like Luke back. Hey, spoiler alerts! But to finally bring like Luke back in his like fully potentialed self, saving the day, was actually really meaningful. And so that's how I remember the second season of The Mandalorian, because
the CG Luke.
It culminated
the Uncanny Valley Luke.
But it doesn't really matter. Like it never matter. You know, look, if I cared about who played Luke Skywalker, we would be talking about the dipshit who's campaigning for fucking Kamala Harris, right? Like we don't give a shit. Like the beauty is, it doesn't matter who plays these people. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't even matter if it's played by a computer.
I agree, but I think Disney just disagrees. Like they think it does matter, which is why like they should have just cast some other young actors. Like it's Luke Skywalker. Okay, whatever. It's fine. It's like they can let their characters die. They don't need to like make CGI Carrie Fisher and CGI Grand Moff Tarkin.
Yeah, I strongly believe that Star Wars there'll be a time after Disney that it, you know, it resurrects once it's free.
In 100 years, when it's free.
I don't think it's 100 years. I think it's going to come sooner than we think. I think it's going to come within the lifetime of this podcast, and we'll be able to talk about it.
Oh, that's optimistic. The Mickey himself, like Steamboat Mickey, is 100 years old now, so he's in open, like what's it called, free to use or something, common.
Yeah, but total pedophile.
All right, he's like, yeah, he's like, and we can say that because he's old enough now. But yeah, like I can't imagine Disney spent what $2 billion on Star Wars. Like they're not gonna let people just make stuff. Like they're gonna get their money back if they have to sue people to do it. They're gonna do it.
So I'm gonna go over the top here now and say Disney doesn't care about the money either, right? Because they've already told us that they've put these quote unquote principles right ahead of the quality of. Every single project loses money. They don't seem to care, right? They're not about getting that money back. It's almost like it's some kind of CIA op to ruin Star Wars, right? That will eventually will run out of strength and be pried away from their hands.
That's true. I mean, yeah, that I agree with that. If like they are not, if they cared about their content, they would be producing better content. So they're
and if they even if they just cared about making their money back or making some of their money back, mm-hmm. right? They're operating like a fucking guy who just bought a Bitcoin miner for $10,000. Right?
They definitely feel it. Definitely seems like they have the opinion that they can operate like this forever, and that money is infinite and will never run out.
Yeah, they're about to, you know, like, yeah, I think they're getting their ass handed to them. And at some point, this is going to get pried out of their hands and they'll make, and, you know, there's enough like, you know, the Dave Filoni projects. If you're just, you know, like Ahsoka was pretty good. You had a season or two of The Mandalorian that was pretty good. You know, and you had some things that were okay. Like, you know, the Book of Boba Fett, things going on in that world were like, okay. And you had fucking disasters like Kenobi and season three of The Mandalorian. That were just total fucking, unfortunately total disasters, right? These are things that like you can't unsee. Like, oh, you know, let's elevate some black female Jedi that doesn't clearly just like doesn't belong in that particular storyline, right? And doesn't
do is that the witches? Is that what you're talking about?
No, the witches were kind of cool. You know, that was a
like, why didn't they like why did no, they have to invent like, new Force witches? Why didn't they use the Night Sisters? Like that already exists in Star Wars.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
But
well, they brought back the Night Sisters. That's what they did with that was the big so that was the big thing with Ahsoka was the Night Sisters working with Grand Admiral Thrawn, who is the character from what was supposed to really be the post trilogy. This was after Return of the Jedi. The first thing we got sometime in the mid 80s was a trilogy book series called Heir to the Empire. And it was about this genius general named Grand Admiral Thrawn. And Disney appeared to be content to ignore it forever. Right. Certainly, you know, certainly he wouldn't have been part of the prequels. So Lucas, you know, there was no mention of him in the prequels and we never even heard of this guy until these books came. But it was like pretty iconic book series, right? If there was ever, if you ever ask if anybody ever read any of those books, what if anyone says yes, they'll say yes. I read Heir to the Empire, and only through Dave Filoni, the Rebels project, and then Ahsoka, he slowly brings this character in, gives him an origin story. Gives him a reason why he disappeared and why we don't know about him, and then gave us the story about how he returned to our world. And that's the stage for Ahsoka season two. It's essentially, it looks as though it's going to be now Heir to the Empire is going to be the new post trip. So I think when the franchise pries itself out of Disney's hands, Dave Filoni is already ready to do this new post trilogy, essentially called Heir to the Empire.
They have enough books out there that are awesome that yeah, all they have to do is just turn these books into films. What I'm getting from this is that we're gonna have to have another episode where we just talk about Star Wars. I'm running up against time. My wife has constraints that she's got to go out with kids. So, but
a common Star Wars problem.
Yeah. Mike, dude, thank you so much for coming on. Give us your handle and where people can find you.
Sure, I'm on Twitter. I'm at RunDanceBitcoin. That's all one word. And I have a podcast. It's called High Hash Rate. You should check it out. I'm so glad to just come up on here and speak with you guys. Very fun.
Yeah, man. Thanks for coming on.
It's a privilege.
Thank you very much for inviting me.